Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Laura Glenn. Glenn is a poet and visual artist. Her poems have appeared in many magazines and journals, including Antioch Review, Epic, Poet Lore, Poetry, and Massachusetts Review. Her art has been exhibited in group shows at State of the Art in Ithaca, Cooperstown Art Association, Main Street Gallery in Groton, and New York University's 80 Washington Square East Galleries. Her first book of poetry, titled I Can't Say I'm Lost, was recently published by Foothills Publishing. And welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you, Tish. Great to be here.
Great. Now, you began writing and creating art as a child, making up stories and illustrating them. Do you remember what motivated you to start doing this?
Well, I think that the general atmosphere in my household was a creative one. I can't say that I have memories of being encouraged to do these things especially, but it's more a matter of having a certain amount of creative activity going on around me. Mm-hmm. That combined with perhaps a tendency toward being a little introspective. I was a pretty spirited child, but I think I was a child who could easily withdraw if there was a setback of any kind.
Uh-huh.
And there always are.
So you probably were a sensitive child.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now, do you remember what some of those early little stories that you illustrated were about? Was it about stuff around you, or were you making up fairy tale-like things?
I don't have too many samples left. But it seems that the one I have the very early works revolved around, you know, animal tales, which were almost like little fables or stories about rescuing animals. And when I got a little older, they became more about human interactions. And sometimes there would be the talking bird that would intervene and communicate where people couldn't. Things like that.
That's great. Oh, that's great. Kids trying to create a world around themselves,
right,
to feel safe in some ways. Right.
I think that the issue of safety has come up in when I look at some of the early works.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say a fourth grade teacher who encouraged creativity might have sparked your interest in poetry. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, in fourth grade, I had a bit zany teacher who encouraged all sorts of creativity, and he did like me a lot. He would sometimes give me a ride home from school in his car. I remember the door was tied on with a thick rope. He was a little eccentric, but we did have some poetry projects going on that year, and I became the editor of the poetry book, and I received a lot of encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
So if I had been interested in other forms of writing before, prior to that time, I think perhaps he got me thinking about poetry.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you discovered poetry, correct?
Well, you know, I don't remember everything about the earlier years, so maybe there was something going on earlier, but that's my first memory of really pursuing poetry.
Uh-huh. And do you remember being read poetry, or did you just immediately start writing in that form? Do you remember that?
We had a house full of books, and we were read to and read on our own, so I think there was some poetry, but I don't really have a specific memory of books of poems. I'm sure there were some.
Mm-hmm.
When I was older, there was a little bit more poetry around.
Mm-hmm. Now, as somebody who has crafted the art and been writing for so many years, are you interested in the music of poetry or the subject more so, or both?
I think it has to be a matter of both. I mean, here and there you come across a poet who's described as amusical. I remember once Alan Dugan was described that way, and his poems are at times wonderful in their own way. But I think music is an important component, but it can be very subtle. Music can be a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So both are important. Yeah, I find both important, too, but in some ways content, it seems to me that can overtake if the music isn't quite as melodic, you know?
Right. I don't think it necessarily has to be melodic, but I think there has to be attention paid to sound. It can be very subtle. I'm a big proponent of half rhymes and little word plays that might not be really obvious until you scrutinize them more carefully.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you're also a visual artist, and then you do abstracts and work with all different mediums. Do you think you're transferring poetry onto a canvas or into an art piece, or is it an entirely different endeavor for you?
It's really a combination. I mean, it's both. In some ways, poetry and art are like opposites to me. And if you could call poetry an escape, which, you know, to some extent it is, although it's also an attempt to enter in the material of life more fully.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that art is even a further escape from that escape. It's an escape into the nonverbal. And in my poetry, I try hard to be concrete And in my artwork, I'm very abstract. But there are a number of points of similarity. Probably a big one is that I strive to connect a number of disparate elements so that, I mean, there are certain poems that begin with a thought that I follow through on, but a lot of poems begin with an image that captivated me that becomes a metaphor, and then maybe other images start to work in, and I have to connect all of these different details, make them cohere. And in my artwork, I have the same thing going on. There's a tendency toward entropy or a little bit of chaos, and I have to find something to connect the parts.
You say that you try to encompass a blend of opposites in your art: energy and calm, focus and chaos. Are you actually in search of some kind of movement in some ways, or stasis? What do you mean by those?
Well,
those opposites?
Like there to be a kind of energy, but sometimes things tilt too far, and it just becomes a little too disturbing to look at, and so I have to. I think I'm never really thinking about opposites when I'm working on something. I've observed retrospectively that there are a lot of what I think of as opposites in my work. I tend to think a lot about balance within myself, within my poetry, within my art. So one example might be if I'm creating a work of art and it looks beautiful to me, but it's really not that interesting, not that I would try to make it the opposite of beautiful. I mean, I appreciate beauty in art. Not all contemporary artists do. But I need to work in a deeper level of meaning, something maybe a little jarring or something that has a depth that goes beyond the surface. I just have a tendency to strive for a balance. If a work is very buoyant, I might find that it needs a little more gravitas. It's not something I do on purpose. It's part of a layered process through which I approach artwork.
And so sometimes it starts with a thought, but when you have that thought, do you know which medium you want to use? Do you know what colors? Or does that just start happening as you get into the work?
There are times when I make a decision to work in a certain color range, and I fulfill that. But there are other times when it's almost as though I am struggling with the whole process of creativity, my will versus the creative process. And I might intend to do something. I might set out to do something and end up with something completely different, including the colors I use.
So it's a mystery, right? When you're getting ready to put an idea onto a canvas or into a piece of art, it's a mysterious road you're going down.
More often than not, it really is.
Well, I want to have you read a poem from I Can't Say I'm Lost. This one's called Being Here, and can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, this poem is a bit grim in some respects. I think I'll read it and then talk about it so as not to create a preconceived way of looking at the poem before it's read. But
okay.
I would like to say that the word oubliette appears in the poem, and an oubliette is a dungeon that has only one opening at the top, a kind of window, and the prisoner is thrown into the dungeon, and it's inaccessible, there's no way out. And the word oubliette is connected to the French word to forget. So, okay, being here. It's like being dead and knowing the space you occupied doesn't need you. When the oak fell, other trees filled in its blue space. Their branches expanded like lungs. You're not dead yet. Friends wait for you to bottom out to the oubliette of this doorless house of memory and crawl back to earth. They'll put up with a story or two about worms and dirt as long as you trail into something else. Show you're able to give your absence a chance to forget how the air caved in. Well, I think like any poem, there are a number of ways of approaching it, but what I think of as important in this poem is the sense of despair that most people experience at some point in their life, a feeling that they're not important, that they've been ignored or forgotten, and then they might even envision their absence. And what do they envision? Okay, the tree is felled, and the other trees fill in the space. It doesn't even matter that they're gone.
So it's in some ways optimistic.
Well, it's interesting that you said that, because I do think it's a despairing poem, but there is an optimistic side to it. And for me, the optimistic side is, well, if you get to the part of the poem where the friends will put up with a story or two, but you have to get beyond what you're going through. I mean, many people can only deal with so much of another person's grief, whether that's good or not. It's just the way it often is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's also a feeling that you really have to get back to life after whatever it is that put you in that state of despair.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you don't have to forget what happened that made you feel that way, but you have to renew yourself. So there is an optimistic side.
Yeah, I love that about it, actually.
Thank you.
It's like a devastated landscape, and of course, nature always comes through.
Right,
and
right.
You find a little flower in a decimated field during World War II, or, you know.
Right.
It's very interesting.
But I also want to say that I don't necessarily think that when someone is gone, I think that sometimes the presence of somebody who's gone can really be felt very strongly throughout life. But the world can be indifferent, too, and nature is a good, you know, we can learn a lot from nature. You're right, that the flower or the tree filling in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I loved about that poem, really.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the title of your book is intriguing to me. I can't say I'm lost, and I know it's based on a poem inside the collection, but why did you name the whole body of work that? It's intriguing.
Well, I think of it as a serious title, but it has a little bit of fun in it, because I'm really, you're kind of flickering back and forth between possible meanings. On the one hand, you know, it sounds like I'm saying I'm lost, but I can't admit it. Or maybe I'm saying, well, I can't say I'm lost. And I'm also playing on, you know, the stereotype of the male who cannot say he's lost, whereas actually...
Oh, right, the male drivers,
right,
who won't admit it, right?
Yeah, on some level I thought of that, although I do have a poor sense of direction, and I'm not hesitant to ask people for help. You know, within the context of the book, it's I can't say I'm lost, but where am I going? So really, if you get beyond the play on all the ambiguities of I can't say I'm lost, I really, the more serious part is struggle to find direction in life. I think that's been an issue for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was intrigued by it. It almost seemed like you were presenting this body of work, and this is the proof that you're not lost.
Well, thank you. Yes, uh-huh. I want there to be innuendos in the title. I hope people pick up on that.
Oh, I think anybody who likes poetry is intrigued by titles, just like
uh-huh.
I am. Yeah. Now, writing is a very solitary endeavor. Is it a jolt to the system when you first read these poems that you've crafted all by yourself in a room to the public?
I wouldn't say that it's a jolt. I think what's important for me is that I read the poems beforehand and get in touch with the material and not read it as if I'm reading it for the first time. I mean, you can gain a little distance on something, and I feel the important thing is to reconnect to the material and experience it a little again before I read it. And I think that makes it less of a jolt. The jolt, I think, can be when you read something very personal in front of other people, and they're, you know, that certainly can make one feel vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely. I would think so. Do you think any of the meanings of your poems have changed by audience reaction or fan reaction or whatever you have received?
Occasionally, somebody will point something out that I hadn't been aware of. But I do think meanings change for me all the time. I'm not really sure. I think it's just part of a process of living more and being able to look back even on one's own work and see things from different viewpoints. In the same way that I might read a book that I read 10 years ago and be amazed that I'm seeing different things. So,
I know that feeling. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Laura Glenn. She's a poet and visual artist. Now you've studied poetry in many different ways, classes, workshops. Is this a helpful place to find your voice as a poet, or do you find yourself trying to please a group or a teacher during some of those times when you're studying with people?
Well, I never went through an MFA program. I did I did college and some graduate school, and only at that point did I realize that I was really deeply interested in poetry and probably should have gone into an MFA program, and I felt that I had to really get on with my life and figure out how to support myself. So it was a very on-and-off process, a very cobbled together education that took place over many years of taking classes and workshops here and there. Sometimes I would enter a poetry group, and it would be a great thing to break away from the isolation of writing. And then at a certain point, I might feel that the group was becoming a little oppressive, and I would need to be out on my own and just writing. Although I must say that I've been in a group for many years in Ithaca, and I'm extremely grateful to have that type of creative exchange.
So you have been able to find your voice, even while reflecting off other people's opinions of your work. And see, that's what I think about workshops and, you know, even book groups. People can sway each other's visions and so on.
Well, I do think about that. You know, there are times when our group suddenly doesn't meet for a month or two, and maybe we just need a little space. But I don't feel too restricted. But it is true that it's possible that things could go in a different direction had I not been in one. I think if I had been in an MFA program, it would have had to have been one that allowed for a great deal of creative freedom. I know that sounds ironic, because obviously you're studying writing. But if it had been too regimented, I would have had exactly the problem that you're bringing up.
Freestyle. Style poets. I've known many that didn't really study poetry, and they're great. A lot of them. Yeah. Now you've taught poetry writing in classes in the elementary school and stuff. Now, I've always thought children's poetry was just amazing. I mean, they're unselfconscious. They don't censor themselves. Have you learned a lot from teaching children? To tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I did that quite a while ago, and I really loved doing it. I guess I just enjoyed the openness of children and the complete unabashedness, the surprise of what they would come up with. I didn't continue to do it because it was far too patchwork in existence. I really didn't know how to manage just being a poetry and art teacher. And I guess I suppose it would have been a great thing to just go on and become a teacher, but I was really interested in these very, very creative aspects of teaching, and you just don't find too many opportunities like that in the school system.
Yeah, unfortunately, and it's becoming more so with the financial crisis that we're going through. The arts is always the first thing to go, which is really, really sad. Now, I want to have you read another poem from I Can't Say I'm Lost. This one's called The Living Room. And again, do you want to talk about it before or wait till afterwards?
I think I will read it first.
Okay.
The living room. The wicker chair sits round the wooden table, content. Across the room, I rock back and forth. I want to be part of the party of non-beings, self-accepting like that clock ticking in another room. I leave the chair still rocking. I'll lighten things up with candles of death and rebirth, the way sunset fills windows of houses with fire without the heaviness of smoke. The stubby candles, an apple core with a dark stem. Let the candle core plump into ripe fruit, the paperweight rock become bread. Let the cheese recoagulate around its holes, the breathing spaces. Let the wine glass fill with grapes. Let the tree knocking on the window come in. I'm restive. Let the wicker chairs sprout twigs with buds, the table grow leaves, the basket unweave into shocks of straw, turn back into waving fields. Let the planter be clay and the ivy climb the walls. Let the moss on the circle of earth, crawl out, cover the floor. Let books discuss each other without envy, or with envy, with admiration. Let the claw foot console prowl the room. I want all eyes on the tiger eye maple open, and the drawers closed, and the desk to have no appointments.
Great. I love some of your imagery.
Thank you.
The sun coming into rooms without smoke. I love that. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that poem. Where did it come from?
Well, to me, this poem is about regeneration. You mentioned the smoke, and I mentioned death in the poem, the kind of the candles of mourning, turning them into something vibrant and lively. It's about getting beyond the things that hold us back, suffering and work, you know, the work that we do, and it can either add meaning to our life or make our lives harder. It can work either way. Mm-hmm. But just getting beyond everything, putting everything aside, sitting, becoming self-accepting, and getting back into a creative state, returning things to their original form. It's kind of a pre-creative moment.
Hmm.
And so I'm trying to return to a moment that makes creativity possible, getting beyond the things that stop us from being creative.
Uh-huh. And that's probably really indescribable unless you do it in poetry.
Yes.
Trying to get to that moment.
Yes.
That's a tough one to try to describe.
Although I must say, I didn't plan to write about that when I wrote the poem. I think this was a poem that kind of took over and grew wild, like some of the things in the poem. but uh-huh. when I looked back at what I'd done, it seemed to me that that's what I was, at least part of what I was getting at.
Mm-hmm. Now, as an artist and a poet, do you find yourself just all through your everyday life constantly saying, I should write that down, or I should create an art piece around this moment? Or do you give yourself a break from having to?
I do that a fair amount. Well, with writing, for example, I often write little notes, and a certain percentage of those notes end up going into a notebook and remaining in that notebook. But what's important for me is if I'm working on a poem, and it can take me quite a while to complete a poem, and I'm tinkering with it and trying to find the right way of saying something. If a line comes to me and it has to do with that particular work in progress, then it becomes more crucial that I write it down. I feel as though I've struggled to say it a certain way, and now I have those words, and I must write them down.
Yeah, yeah. I used to write poetry, and I find writing such a gift. You know, when it comes to you, it's such a gift, and sometimes it's such a surprise.
It is, and it can be it's such a wonderful thing when it comes with ease, but there are times when it's important to work hard to get the results that one wants.
Uh-huh. Now, do you feel a responsibility as an artist to express yourself and communicate with the world around you in that way?
As I get older, I feel that more. You know, now that I've published a first book, which is a real shuffle of old and new poems, and I have enough poems to make a new book, but I felt I really wanted some of those old poems to be represented.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, looking back at what I've included in the book, and I'm very happy about the book, but, you know, it does make me think more about what I want to say. And I guess for me, the problem is that I don't want to predetermine what I should say. It won't happen even if I decide that it should. When I have to write something, I write about it. But I do think it's important to consider who's receiving the material. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking about that more and more now.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting. And it's been as you have gotten older or as you had a book published?
As I've gotten older, you know, it won't necessarily stop me from publishing something, but I'm a little more aware that it can feel awkward, and I do wonder at times what I wish to communicate, but I don't like the idea of being too sensorial and inhibiting myself.
I understand that.
There's a kind of balance that I've been thinking about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've had quite a few poems published in magazines and journals. How do you deal with the rejection side of being a writer?
It's important to be stoic, but it's not always possible for me to take my own advice. I would advise other poets to realize that it's very subjective, and there are all sorts of stories about writers who've been rejected who have ended up succeeding. But sometimes I have to stop trying to publish because even if there are acceptances along the way, rejections can feel as though they're kind of quashing me or
Well, it must feel like a personal attack because poetry is so often personal.
Yes, well, it can feel that way, and it really shouldn't. But I mean, I've had poems, you know, that were rejected by magazines that were not especially noteworthy and accepted by really wonderful places. So it's really hard to interpret that, you know, what it means to be rejected. But it can be difficult.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet it is. And have you ever gotten a rejection from somebody who took the time to tell you why? And that helped you as a writer?
Yes. There have been a few occasions on which a rejection was a delight to receive. That sounds self-punishing, and I don't mean it that way. But but when somebody is paying attention and giving advice, which I may or may not take, but I really appreciate that correspondent, that type of correspondence. And just as a total aside, more often than not, if somebody is expressing that degree of interest, they will eventually take a poem. I haven't been submitting many poems lately because I'm concentrating on other things now.
Yeah, I would think of rejection in some ways as part of the whole creative process. It has to be if you want to get your stuff out there. So,
well, there is, you know, there is for me a bit of an issue between the desire to create and to do good work and the desire to publish. Those are two separate strands that intertwine, and it's important that the poet be, I mean, this sounds a little corny, but be true to oneself as much as possible. It's easy to kind of give in and say, I'd like to write something that will be accepted. Mm. And I just think it's important not to lose sight of the reasons, the original reasons for writing.
Mm-hmm. Then do you feel as a poet, I've often wondered this, do you feel like that your words are your own personal way of trying to make sense of the world around you and your life? Is it that deliberate?
Sometimes. I mean, some poems really are about a struggle to find meaning in an experience. I am a person who ruminates a lot. I think a lot about things that happen. And the writing a poem allows me to think in a very different way, because there even a poet who writes in free verse has all sorts of, you know, self-made rules and restrictions that seem necessary to make the poem succeed. So you're forced to think within certain restrictions, and sometimes it can yield interesting results. I can't say that every poem I write is an attempt to grapple with important issues in my life, but there are some that are.
Mm-hmm. And we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you, do you have any way of describing what your life would have been like without poetry?
I can't imagine what it would have been like. It can be a struggle to be a creative person and find a way to survive and live a full life when you're doing this very solitary activity and have other issues that have to be dealt with. But for me, it's more a question of, I might have preferred to have found better ways to make the poetry work for me, maybe teaching more or doing something that allowed me to write without having to struggle with so many survival-related issues. But I would never want to give up poetry or art, for that matter. They're both really important to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura Glenn, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate your interest.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.